Many don't believe that either the trumpets with melodious noise or the infernal din await us where the road ends. But most, I fancy, have discovered that to be born is to be exposed to delights and miseries greater than imagination could have anticipated. That the choice of ways at any crossroads may be more important than we think, and that shortcuts may lead to very nasty places.
Pilgrim's Podcast, and I am your patriarchal host, A. Alan.
I'm the progeny, your host, Hannah Long.
And this host B.
We're coming to you from somewhere in the wilds of Appalachia, the home of the permanent spoiler. And lastly, from beyond the grave, our mystery host, Professor Clive Staples Lewis, an Irish apologist known for Mere Christianity, the Screwtape Letters, and the Chronicles of Narnia. He's coming to us from the Holy Trinity Churchyard in Oxford. Welcome to the show, Professor Lewis. Now, today, we're going to be talking about Raiders of the Lost Ark.
What shall we talk about?
We are going to talk about Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is the first Indiana Jones movie. Came out in 1981.
You know, it wouldn't have worked if it had been like Arkansas Jones.
Probably not.
West Virginia Jones.
Well, you know, it was nearly Indiana Smith. Seriously. But, because...
That wouldn't have been quite so bad.
Well, what happened was, it was George Lucas's idea. He was in hiding after Star Wars.
The second great idea that George Lucas has ever had. Or will ever have, unfortunately.
And he was on the beach, and he thought up this idea, and he called up his friend, Steven Spielberg, and he said, "I've got this great idea, and I don't have time to do it." Thank God he called Spielberg, otherwise he would have done it, and then it would have been terrible.
But he co-wrote it, right?
Yeah, he did. Him and Lawrence Kasdan.
How could he write that and then in the same life write a script with Jar Jar Binks in it?
Well, there was a co-writer. I think that must be it.
I hope that guy got his reward.
Well, he was a co-writer on this, and I think he was a co-writer on The Empire Strikes Back as well.
The other guy?
Yeah, Lawrence Kasdan.
So there you have it.
It's a wonder we don't know his name instead. But brief summary of the plot for those of you who might not have seen it in a long time.
Which is hard to believe, but go ahead.
Well, you know. It's about an archaeologist named Indiana Jones who who goes about finding idols and other miscellaneous
artifacts
in countries all around the globe, and then comes back and is a kind of a Clark Kent-like professor in his free time. In this movie, the government approaches him and says, We think that the Nazis, this is the 1936, we think the Nazis are about to find the lost Ark of the Covenant, and he decides to go after it for them. In the process, he immediately goes to Mongolia, where he comes across a person who's been running a bar in the middle of nowhere, drinking hard, smoking hard, and who says when he comes through the door, of all the gin joints in all the towns and all the world, I knew you'd walk right back through that door, Indiana Jones. And that's Marion Ravenwood.
Indiana Smith.
And he goes off with Marion Ravenwood, his girlfriend, and fights Nazis and finds the Ark of the Covenant and then loses the Ark of the Covenant and has a variety of adventures. And that's pretty much the summary. It's kind of a continuation.
Where did you see it first?
Where did I see it first?
Do you remember the first time you watched it?
I don't really. I was very young.
Mm-hmm.
I was very young. Well, I ended up buying the DVDs. I don't remember when exactly I saw them first. Now, I know that you remember it.
I do remember that. And I saw it. I was apparently around 16. It came out in 81?
Yeah, 81.
And I saw it on the in the, well, I was sitting in the back of in the bed of a pickup truck that was parked at the Skyview Drive-In in Marion, Virginia. And
there goes our anonymity.
But the
everybody knows where HQ is now.
But you know, I guess I had heard about it at school, and that, or I think I'd heard about it and thought, you know, I knew it was about an archaeologist, and it was just something you had to go see. And I remember thinking, how much fun could that possibly be? And so, if I'm not mistaken, I went with my sister and her boyfriend at the time, and you know, we turned the pickup around backwards and park it beside the cruddy speakers and go get your popcorn or whatever. And you know, the first 15 minutes or so, it's just amazing. I truly was, my jaw was probably completely dropped open for that first 15 or 20 minutes. I just could not believe what I was seeing. And then, you know, back in those days, it's not like you could go out and get the DVD or look up the trailer on YouTube or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, it was truly just kind of word of mouth. I seriously doubt I'd seen any kind of a trailer for it. Maybe had read something about it in the newspaper, but that would have been the only warning as to what, you know, the story was going to be about. So, man, I remember talking to the kids the next day or there two at school about kind of walking them through that first 15 minutes or so, and it was,
and suddenly every 15-year-old boy in the world wanted to be an archaeologist.
Yeah, something like that, you know.
Which is a subset of human anthropology.
Well, it's
and nobody knows what anthropology means, but everybody knows what archaeology means.
Well, I think it just kind of, also, it kind of opened up my eyes anyway to the possibilities of that things that, you know, you could kind of look for the unexpected, that you could look for, not necessarily adventure, but for, you know, all the preconceived notions of what one might have for as an archaeologist or for a doctor or for, you know, a mason or a stonemason, just about anything, then kind of it became a little more intriguing. And it's really kind of what you make out of it.
Just because you're an archaeologist doesn't mean you can't fight Nazis.
That's right.
Yep.
That was a fun ride, and it had, you know, I think it had a sizable effect on my, especially what I look for in a film from then on. And it was just a rollicking good time.
Yeah, it's a film that really never lets go of the fun aspect of it. It's just having a lot of fun the whole time through, and it's Spielberg at his best. He is.
Yes.
He can polarize. At this point in his career, he was wanting to kind of get a little bit more serious. After that, you know, he was wanting to kind of go into Schindler's List and that sort of thing. And he.
So what had he done up to now? He'd probably done Jaws.
I'm not sure.
I think he did Jaws. I think Jaws came out in the 70s.
I mean, Last Crusade was the one where he was kind of on the brink of becoming a drama filmmaker. He'd done a lot of adventure stuff and kind of thrillers and that sort of thing. And the more...
The Duel.
And...
Or just Duel, I think is what it's called.
With Spielberg, you've got the especially his kind of trademark tendency, his sentimentality. It can be really sentimental, like Hook sentimental. On the other hand, when he does do, and even a lot of his dramas can be very sentimental. I think with this one, he really keeps that sentimentality off to one side. He has a lot of fun with it. He doesn't make it sappy, but he has a lot of fun. And it's also, I know that kind of your keystone. Touchstone.
Restraint.
It's a very restrained movie, partly because he was in trouble with the studios at the time for overshooting the budget, I think, on The Color Purple, which it was his...
Hang on, that was much later.
Oh, okay.
I would have loved to have been in on those. I would have loved to have been when they pitched this to the studio, because...
They did not want to make it. They said, oh, that's going to be extremely expensive. That's crazy. What are you thinking? And he talked them into it. He basically talked them into it on the condition that he made it under budget and under schedule, basically. Because he'd gone over schedule and he'd gone 2.5 times over budget on his previous movie. And he wanted to come back from that, and that's what he did. He finished a good bit under time and with exactly the right budget. So he was really really happy with that. And you can see it in the script. It never really becomes,
you know. And you wonder if I mean, I know that, like, in my job and in a lot of the jobs that I've seen in my career, is that some people work better under pressure. And it makes you wonder that after that...
Peter Jackson, for one.
Well, yeah, but after Raiders of the Lost Ark, I think in particular, he could do no wrong. And he was going to get any kind of budget he wanted, and he could basically write his own ticket. But it makes you wonder if he would not have worked more creatively and actually produced better films in some ways later on, if they had continued to really push him. And maybe they do in somewhat. I mean, it's not like he has an unlimited budget.
I mean, he can pretty much do anything he wants.
But
to
he can pretty much do anything he wants. His yeah.
The two directors I think of when I think of that are Peter Jackson, number one. Mm-hmm. Fellowship of the Ring was probably his best film because nobody knew whether it was going to be good or not.
Yeah, but no one's probably there.
And Kenneth Branagh. Because Henry V, that's...
But he doesn't have the power that Spielberg does.
No, but later he went on, and the more... Because Henry V was his first movie, and he made it on a shoestring budget, and it's the best. All the other...
Yeah.
Hamlet was way over the top, and it had some good bits, but it was just too much. But we're kind of getting off track here.
And it had Jack Lemmon in it.
Which was way off track.
For another day.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I think that was the movie that came before. Oh, and by the way, I just looked up Lawrence Kasdan, and it's looking like he's going to be... He also did Return of the Jedi and Silverado.
Which is a great movie.
Really?
Silverado is a great movie with great music.
And he's the writer for... He's going to be writing...
And maybe Kevin Costner's best movie ever.
He's going to be writing the upcoming Star Wars movies.
Really?
Do you think
they'll have bullwhips?
Possibly. It's entirely possible.
You know, they should have, like, instead of lightsabers, they should have light bullwhips or something.
That would be pretty cool.
That would be cool.
It would just be like, kind of, yeah, that would be pretty awesome. Maybe, you know, we copyright this idea for anybody who's listening. The studios are going to have to call us and talk about it.
Yeah, Steve will have to... You'll have to give me some plane tickets to California.
The Indiana Jones is kind of the king of the swashbuckler genre. They're up through the earlier 1900s, you had a bunch
even
of...
Even though he's not on a boat.
Even though he's not on a boat. Well, you don't have to be on a boat to be a swashbuckler.
Yes,
you just
you
have
do.
You have to have a belt.
You have to buckle your swash.
You have to buckle your swash. Well, he's got a swash to buckle. It mostly involves how you carry yourself.
He has an axe to grind.
Well, there were a lot of kind of pulp novels.
Nazis.
And
Nazis.
Comic books. And all the 12-year-olds and the 13-year-olds, when Spielberg was growing up, were watching these serials on the radio of adventure heroes and guys who were going off and getting the girl and riding into the sunset. So it really takes that genre and makes it into something. It combines all sorts of things. It's combining the kind of the swashbuckler element of it, a really exciting action adventure. It's got some romance that is just enough to kind of keep you interested. and it's got a great sidekick, Solace. It's got it's got the ultimate villains. The Nazis are always the ultimate villains. It's even got a little bit of spirituality in there. It's kind of tapping into the religious heritage of every kid that's going into the theater in America is going to know what the Ark of the Covenant is.
And would they now?
Would they now? Probably not.
I don't know if they did back then.
Well,
I mean, I probably knew what it was in general. And that was another neat thing, which is that, you know, you're brought up in Sunday school and you're, you know, can we just please get this over with kind of Sunday school classes sometimes. And
didn't you tell us at the Sunday school?
And yes, I knew generally what the Ark was, but if you'd asked me what was supposed to have been in it, I certainly wouldn't have known. And so, you know, when they come to, that's kind of a neat thing from the movie, is that they never tell you what's inside it, but it's kind of a mystery the whole way through, is what's inside that box.
Well, you know? Actually, I'm pretty sure they mentioned that it's supposed to be the stone tablets, cause
no, I don't think they do.
Don't they?
No, I think they say that it's a radio. It's a radio, Anna.
It's a radio for talking to God.
So it's a two-way radio. Well, maybe it's a one-way radio.
Well, I think it ends up being a one-way radio. In the end, it's very one-way.
Yes.
So, yeah, it brings all of that in. It kind of brings in a historical mystery. You see a lot of that on reality TV shows anymore, of kind of historical mystery. It kind of popularized the idea of I just finished a book, for instance, called The Daughter of Time, which is about Richard III, and it's a historical mystery, saying, did he, in fact, kill his nephews? And it's a really, really interesting story, and I think it kind of draws from that sort of thing, though, okay, that came first, but it also taps into a historical mystery. It crosses through so many genres.
I would love to know who had that idea.
George Lucas.
For the Ark?
For the Ark. I'm not sure if it was him that had the Ark
idea. I would love to know who had that idea, because they knew, you know, they had to go to Sunday school a little bit. They had to know what the, because it was brilliant. It was just a brilliant, what did you call it earlier?
MacGuffin.
MacGuffin. Is that anything like a McMuffin?
We can hope.
Yeah. Was that with a little C or a big C? Is it an M-A-C? It's not a Mac Guffin. It's a Mick Guffin, right?
It's an M-A-C-G-U-F-F-I-N. It
M-A-C.
Is.
M-A-C.
It is. And basically a MacGuffin is a trope, or it's an item that only exists as a plot point. It basically could be anything else. Now, in this one, I don't think it's so much a MacGuffin, because it couldn't be anything else, because it ends up actually being a character in the end there. And it actually ends up being a big deal.
Well, it was brilliant, because I don't know what other relic. Well, I don't know. I've thought about that every once in a while. Is what other relic could they have went after, other than the Holy Grail, which obviously they kind of picked up that theme later on, but that could it was perfect, because a lot of people knew, had heard of it, but really didn't know much about it. But at the same time, it was mysterious enough to where, you know, hey, what is in that? You know, and what ever did happen to that Ark, by the way? You know, I don't remember what happened to the Ark in the Bible. And so, it really served a purpose well. And so when they
Philip Kaufman, he apparently, some dude who worked with Lucas, came up with the idea of the Ark of the Covenant.
Well, that was brilliant. That was absolutely brilliant, because it fit all of the, it hit all the buttons, and just seemed just mysterious enough and just plausible enough, you know, because it was certainly a, you think about the Holy Grail, well, it was one cup among many. It was probably, you know, it was, number one, it's probably a small bowl or whatever, you know, I don't know what they used over there at that time, but But it was probably
if it actually existed.
Right, it would have been collected up with everything else and gone and washed or.
Yeah,
right?
But there's no mistaking the Ark of the Covenant.
But there's no mistaking the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, it's very iconic.
Right, and so it was just brilliant. I love it.
Yeah, I wonder, I wonder where they got the idea for it being a weapon. Because the Nazis want it because they want it to turn into a weapon.
Because
in the Bible, it's never really... Well, when the Philistines have it.
Yeah, I don't think... Well, the Philistines get it because it... Right, because they took it from the children of Israel.
Yeah,
because
they wanted to use it as a weapon.
So what it means to me is, well, then it's not... You know, then the army is not undefeatable because they were defeated enough to where they could... The ark was stolen by someone else or taken by someone else.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but nonetheless, it's...
Well, the Nazis were not known for knowing their Bible all that well.
Well, but neither are we. I mean, the filmmakers knew that, and they knew that they could say, well, it's, you know, the army that marches with the ark is undefeatable, and it's a radio for talking to God, and it's this huge weapon. You know, and so everybody, you know, all the 16-year-old boys that were sitting in the back of the truck are going, I didn't remember that in the Bible, but that sounds awfully good to me.
Let's go look it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... Well, I looked up a few of the locations that... Because there are still rumors about where it is now. And there's...
I think it's in my mom's basement.
I think that's entirely possible because I went through her attic and found the Holy Grail. One of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church claims to possess the Ark of the Covenant. And it's kept in a... It's kept in... a treasury near the Church of Our Lady Mary of Zion. So, possibly it's in Ethiopia. And then there's also Mount Nebo. That's a possibility. And in the Limba people of South Africa and Zimbabwe have claimed that their ancestors carried the Ark south, calling it the Ngoma Mungundu, or Voice of God, eventually hiding it in a deep cave in the Dumge Mountains, their spiritual home.
Cool.
Now, even in Europe, there was a French author who claimed that the Ark was taken to the Chartres Cathedral by the Knights Templar.
But it's a French, you know. I mean, come on.
And
take chances.
I'm butchering this French here. René Le Chateau, then to the United States. Oh, possibly. Several recent authors have theorized that the Ark, I'm just reading this off Wikipedia, people, was taken from Jerusalem to the village of René Le Chateau in southern France. Also possibly Rome, the United Kingdom. I think everybody has an urban legend about where it is. So, Ireland.
That makes a lot of sense.
Tutankhamun's tomb, possibly. So, yeah, it could be anywhere. It's probably somewhere, but of course we know the truth. It's in my mamaw's basement. Of course, in the end, it turns out that the Nazis actually were wrong, because it's not really a weapon.
What is it?
It's like one of those...
It's a MacGuffin.
No, it's not, because MacGuffins don't fight back.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be just an item. It ends up being a really interesting thing because of the way it resolves the plot in the end. And that's one of the things I want to talk about, which was, is it fair? Is it fair to basically tie up your main characters and then suddenly the Ark of the Covenant explodes and all the bad guys die?
Yeah, it works perfectly.
I think so, too. A lot of people, I think, would say it's a deus ex machina, which is basically Latin for God of the Machine, which is another trope, but... Another trope, which basically means that it's divine intervention, so it's not fair. It's just the writers being lazy. But in this case, I think it really works.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't work every time, but it sure worked here, you know, because Indy kind of needed a little help. And, you know, and that we watched it here. We watched it a few days ago, kind of in anticipation of this recording, and Whereas in the past when I've watched the movie, I would just kind of get buckled in and go along for the ride and have a wonderful time and reminisce and think, oh yeah, this is coming up and isn't that fun to see, you know, and all those good things. But in this time, the one plot flaw that really jumped out to me that I've not really thought about before is when Indiana Jones is up at the top of the he's got the little shoulder RPG or shoulder rocket, and he says, you know, I'm gonna blow you guys all up, which is just ridiculous. I mean, that just didn't seem.
I think he was threatening to blow the Ark of Covenant up.
He was. He wanted Marion back. You can take the Ark, but give me the girl, right?
Yeah.
It didn't seem to fit. I mean, I've always taken.
I thought that really worked because his relationship with her up until that point had been the big issue. Indiana has one cardinal virtue. His cardinal virtue is a sort of academic purity of things belong in a museum. That is what the code that he lives by. And he will sacrifice anything to do that. Well, and that includes Marion. And that was why you had to have that.
But
that
he had to know that. That's what I mean. Is he had to know that they were going to play that card, and
Well, he's an impulsive guy.
Yeah, but he should have. I mean, to me, if I'm in Indiana Jones, I'm going to look for my opportunity to get her and get. I'm not going to play all my cards. He didn't think ahead, in other words. What I'm saying is he didn't think ahead to how they were going to play the game.
Yeah, I think he probably thought that he would have been able to call their bluff on that. But ultimately, I tend to think he probably would have prioritized the Ark above her. He would have tried to figure out a way of getting it.
Well, yeah.
Which is, of course, what he did. But when he was put in the position of doing that, he wouldn't have been standing surrounded by Nazi guards. He would have figured that out. But you know, they needed to wrap it up.
Yeah, that's right.
The thing that...
Like I said, I've always bought it up until this last time. I mean, it just seemed to... It's okay.
Yeah, the thing that kind of bothered me was the fact that he rode on top of the submarine for miles and miles and miles, and they never went underwater.
Yeah, that's a little bit. Yeah, that's true, too.
Though I think there's a deleted scene that explains that. And I couldn't find it, but it's probably out there somewhere.
It is a U-boat. I don't know what the normal protocol is with that. And then it's kind of hard to tell on the scale of the
world. It was 1936. I mean, war hadn't been declared yet, so it was probably
kind of hard to tell on the little map how far they're going. If it's 20 miles, you know, you think, okay, maybe so. If it's 50 miles at X knots, which I don't know. We're landlubbers. What do I know about knots? But I think... that's another one. You just have to suspend disbelief a little bit. And is that the word? Suspend disbelief?
Yeah.
And buy into it. Not to mention that, you know, they pull it into the boat dock there, and I guess he's still on top of it.
And nobody knows.
Or hanging off the side.
Well,
or whatever
you can jump into the water.
I guess so.
Yeah, because you're Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Indiana Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that kind of brings up some questions about Indy as a character. Do you think he's unique as an action? I mean, because a lot of them are kind of indistinguishable from one another. Bruce Willis playing Bruce Willis again.
Yeah, because I mean, I don't know of anybody else that could have pulled that off.
Other than Harrison Ford.
Yes, because. It's the little mannerisms that I don't know how any other actor would have really, pulled that off and added so much content through his mannerisms more than anything else to complete the character. Period. There are literally probably dozens of little looks and glances and I'm thinking of...
Yeah, he does a terrific job mixing confidence and vulnerability and...
You know, when he's in the... We were talking about the U-boat scene there. When they pull it into the dock and he's the guy comes up and starts dressing him down for being out of uniform and, you know, being looking scruffy and all. Just watching his little...
Because the camera stays on his face.
The camera stays on his face, and he's just... He's playing it, the whole thing. And you can see what's going on in his mind, you know, which is, okay, how am I going to get out of this? And, oh, yeah, you know.
Yeah, I think my favorite Indiana Jones moment, or just at least in this movie, is the moment when he's looking up and he's in the pit with all the snakes, 7,000 of them, incidentally, and Belloc has just turned up and, you know, he makes some sort of joke. He's like, you just... And, you know, he leans over and cusses. And it's just so great because he doesn't even break his smile. And it's just, it's great. So.
Yeah. And I don't know how anybody else pulls that off. He really made the character. I don't think it really ever came, he never was able to recreate that so much in the other movies later on.
Well, this is the movie where it's really, it's a... It forms the myth. It's very mythic. It's very... He's nothing like any of the... For the most part, he's not much like a modern hero who would be very introspective and have all sorts of demons right in front of you, you know, saying, oh, well, you know, my wife was killed in a motor accident many years ago, and I have nightmares about it and insecurity.
He's an American.
I know. He's great. I mean, he like, epitomizes everything that's best, everything that's worst about America, going in and shooting up people, and then everything that's best about America, going in and shooting up people. It's great.
He does have a, that's another, I would say that's another very, very strong characteristic that appealed to me then, and still does, which is the ingenuity. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to jump to the next movie just because this thing came into my mind. But when when one of the stone ceiling is coming down, what does he do? Well, he grabs...
I don't remember.
Right. Well, I do. That's why I'm here. He grabs a skull and he wedges it between the corner of the ceiling and the wall, which is exactly what you would do. That is, if you don't have a strut or something, that was an ingenious, and that whole point in that movie later on, is probably like 3 seconds, even if it's that long, you know. But that's also represented in
Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's a character moment, yeah. In the first sequence, this was the second movie that we've done. And it's also the second movie that has a long opening sequence in which you don't see the face of the main character for a long time, because it's building up who he is as a character, and it's also building a mystique around him. There's something very mysterious. You don't know him. He's in the shadows, and you don't see his face until you see that he's very canny. He knows when somebody's about to try and assassinate him in the first few minutes. And then he goes down, and that entire opening sequence just completely sets up the character.
Absolutely.
And it also sets up kind of the dynamic for the rest of the movie, which is Indy gets something, Indy almost manages to escape, gets beat up, and then it gets stolen right out from under his nose by Belloc or by anybody else.
Yeah, and that was good writing. That's great writing right there, because, you know, temptation there as a writer would be to say that he either keeps it or that he manages to get it back and deliver it but say, you know, Belloc almost got it, you know, he's after me, or to make the rest of the movie trying to get that back. But once he's got it, once Belloc takes off with it, they don't return to that.
He lets it go, and that's
go,
the end of it.
You know, and it really, that shows a lot of restraint, and it shows a lot of good writing.
Yeah, I think that the constant
failures of Indiana Jones, and we talked about this a little bit before the show, and I read you part of Jeffrey Overstreet's book, Through a Screen Darkly, where he talks about kind of the really interesting characteristic that puts Indy apart from other really self-reliant heroes and kind of boisterous, manly heroes, is that he has a humility about him because he's a constant underdog and because he's always being defeated. And in the end, he doesn't even save the day. Divine intervention saves the day. And he's only saved because he's humble enough to look away. And I think that's really interesting because he combines the best of the self-reliant heroes. He's very clever.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would say that he's smart enough to look away. But I think it's a good point, is that...
He knows that at some point he's smart enough to know that he can't rely on himself.
Well, and he may remember Marcus's words, which is that, you know, this is not like anything you went after before. And those words may come back to him, and there may be a humility that's a part of that. That's a neat idea. I like that. I like that line of thinking.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to Han Solo in a way. He has to kind of learn to respect.
Hey, he shot first.
He did shoot first. And in this one, he shot first, and the other guy was unarmed.
Yeah. Can you believe it?
Yeah, that's one of the best moments in his cinema history. I mean, you know, whatever the anti-NRA people are out there, they're going to put us on the blacklist just for this episode. I really like the fact that he balances self-reliance with an awareness that sometimes you can't rely on yourself. And so that really gives him... But at the same time, he's not crippled. He's not vulnerable like, say, Iron Man. Iron Man these days, Iron Man 3 in particular, is so caught up in self-discovery and trying to solve his
psychological conundrums
that he's just not interesting anymore because he's a wimp. I mean, who cares about that sort of problem? People care about it when you're trying hard and you're trying to do something, but you're not sitting around and crying about it. Get over it. And I really like that about him. Which brings us to the music. It has John Williams.
It has music.
It's just great. Yeah, it does actually. John Williams is amazing. What other soundtracks did he do?
You ought to watch this movie. I wonder if you could watch it without the music. What it would be like.
It would probably be terrible.
Yeah, probably be.
Because there's the moment where...
Yeah, it's pretty brilliant.
There's the moment where Indy is in the water and then he climbs up onto the submarine and all the pirates are looking out across the water. And the music just comes out, and I just want to jump out of my seat and cheer. I'm just like, yeah, he made it. It's great.
And that's one of the little Harrison Ford moments when he's on top of the submarine, kind of looking around like, okay, you know, I caught the dog. Now what do I do with it?
And for once in his whole career, Indiana Jones looks around, and there's a whole crowd of people cheering for him. And he kind of gives him a little salute, and it's just great, you know.
Yeah, that the music is definitely, I don't know if the movie would have been quite as great without that music. I really don't. I mean, it is a significant part of that.
Incidentally, there is a thing on the internet. There's this video.
There's a thing on the internet?
There is a thing on the internet. And you're making me lose it now. It's the final scene in Star Wars, A New Hope, without the music.
Yes,
and
you should go see it.
It's great. And it's a scene that is entirely without dialogue, and it lasts for a good minute and a half.
And now we know why Chewbacca was in the films. It was so that they could make this little clip.
It was. And
because he's the star of the show.
Yep, and it makes you realize how very much John Williams is the star of every every show.
Yeah.
Besides Star Wars, what other music did he do? I mean, he did Superman. He did, of course...
He did the Olympics.
Did he?
And I think he did the NBC News.
one of his lesser known. He did the original theme song to Gilligan's Island, I think.
No way.
But it was not the one that everybody knows. There was an alternate version. It was cheesy.
Sure it wasn't.
But it was
Schindler's List.
Yeah, Schindler's List. I'm sure.
Did he do Empire of the Sun?
He did do Empire of the Sun. I think Empire of the Sun may be my favorite, just because. I mean, the others are so iconic, but I'm a hipster, so I'm gonna go with Empire of the Sun. I think it's great. It was nominated for an Oscar, but it lost to Chariots of Fire.
What did?
The music for Indiana Jones.
They lost to Chariots of Fire?
Yes. So there's the question. Which one should have won?
That's a tough one. That's a tough one. Because I'm not a big fan of Vangelis, but that's a great movie. Chariots of Fire is a great movie.
Upcoming.
I tend to think Williams should have got it. But I would probably
it's
give
it. It's a mix because.
Would you have given the Academy Award to Chariots of Fire or to Indiana Jones?
Probably Indiana Jones. Yeah,
really?
Definitely Indiana Jones. Because it was more original. Chariots of Fire, it's a really good movie, but it has some cheesy stuff in it. The slow motion thing, it's kind of self-important at times. And that Chariots of Fire's music is more original than Indiana Jones's music. Indiana Jones's music is I think in general it's better, because Chariots of Fire music, sometimes it's good, sometimes it isn't. It's kind of uneven. And of course there's the really famous theme song. But Indiana Jones's music, it's never bad.
They should have put Eric Little in Indiana Jones.
Now,
would that have worked?
Now, Ian Charleston is Indiana Jones. That would have been really interesting.
Or else put Harrison Ford in Chariots of Fire.
And when I run, I feel his pleasure. Yes. Yep. Mary and I knew that one day I'd walk right back through that door. That's the Scottish Indiana Jones. So what would that be? Glasgow Jones instead of Indiana Jones? Edinburgh Jones?
So.
Edinburgh Jones. There we go. That's the European version.
Alistair Jones. Which is a nod to Alistair Begg. If you're listening to Alistair Begg, you're my hero.
Yeah, if I ever meet Alistair, then I'm just going to walk up to him and say, excuse me, can you say, and when I run, I feel his pleasure. I'd just love to hear that, sorry.
And then there's the special effects.
The special effects, which come out most prominently in the final scene with the melting Nazis.
I'm melting.
Incidentally, they're selling a, you know, the Major Tot, the little creepy Gestapo guy with the shaved head.
What should we talk about?
They've made a candle of his head, and you light the candle and his face melts away with the candle.
It's a great Christmas gift.
It's on my bucket list. They actually cast him because he reminded Spielberg of Peter Lorre. Though, come to think of it, I asked my brother whether he could think of any kind of similar action heroes to Indiana Jones, and he immediately said Rick Blaine from Casablanca, which I think is really funny.
But the best,
because my brother knows Casablanca.
But the best special effects in the movie, by far, are the punches. They're bone-crunching punches.
The sound effects are terrific.
And the guns. The guns and the punches, especially the punches, because up until then, and even after that, like, I grew up in the 70s, and so you're watching all these Mannix and Hawaii 5-0 and all these detective shows, and there were, you know, when they get into fights or whatever, there may be like this,
yeah,
this light slap or
we
whatever.
We just watched,
you know,
The Godfather, and I remember watching the Sonny was punching one of the characters, and it was terrible.
Yeah, but when,
because I mean, you could see that his fist going by him, compared to this, it was.
They did a really good job with that, because when people get punched in this movie, you can feel it.
The thing that's really hard to do in a lot of action movies is create a sense of danger. because a lot of movies are so over the top, Hobbit, that it feels like a video game instead of actual stakes. And this movie, you never lose the stakes. It's never too funny. There's always a sense of danger. It's very edge of your seat type stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you go back again to watching this the first time.
Well, I mean, I still get caught up in the sequence where he's dragging himself under the cart, which
yeah, but you know
a guy how, actually did that.
Yeah, but you know how that's gonna, you know how it ends.
Yeah.
And again, if stepping into a 16-year-old and watching this for the first time, and as the cat and mouse, you know, the tension builds and the chess pieces are continuing to move, and this whole game is going on of give and take. You know, it's his at one moment, and then it's theirs, and then it's his, and then it's theirs. And
yeah, it really doesn't let up.
It really doesn't let up, and so it really comes to a terrific. It's just a really well written. I wouldn't say suspense or even action. Just almost.
Yeah, the sound effects.
What is the word?
Swashbuckler. It's swashbuckler. It's a swashbuckler. Because a guy who, he has the style. It's all about style. It doesn't, and it's like
style.
a lot of the previous types of this sort of hero you had, and I think that's why my brother pointed out Rick Blaine from Casablanca. It's because they're so cool. Zorro, he had the sword and the whip, and he swung around and saved people, and
I think C.
and the Scarlet Pimpernel. And it was very cool. I looked up the sound effects. It says that they used a 30 Winchester rifle.
Yes.
For the sound of Jones's pistol.
Yeah, that would work.
Now that's a heavy duty pistol. And they struck leather jackets and baseball gloves with a baseball bat to create a variety of punching noises and body blows.
Yes.
Oh, and for the snakes. They there were fingers running through cheese casserole. And sponges sliding over cement. Incidentally, the sliding lid on a toilet cistern provided the sound for the opening of the ark. And they used the Wilhelm scream when a Nazi falls from a truck, which you hear that in movies all the time. It's a very famous scream from some dude named Wilhelm, and you'll hear it in movies all the time. So that has been your fact for the day, and the screams of the things coming out of the ark at the end were dolphins and sea lions. Though, yeah. Speaking of the ending, though, we've got our Nazis and our villains, and pretty much every race is really stereotyped in this. The American is self-reliant, and the British guy is kind of mustache twirly, and he stands over there with his evil plan, and the Germans are tall and scary, and then there's the kind of cute Arabian sidekick. So what do you think about the Nazis? How do the Nazis work as villains?
Well, they do very well. I mean,
they're very good at it.
Yeah, when you got a I hadn't thought much about it, but they fill in nicely for the bad guys, and they fill in nicely because you can kind of imagine that why they would want the Ark, and I guess, you know, and like when the colonel or whoever is toward the end, he says, you know, I'm not very comfortable with this Jewish ritual or whatever.
Yeah.
And he says it in such a way that you think, you know, he really isn't comfortable with it. So it just kind of gives you...
Well, I guess the two more interesting villains are Belloc and the creepy, slimy Gestapo guy, who... The Gestapo guy, I'm on and off. He's creepy and everything, and he's he's okay. I think that the thing with his coat hanger was pretty cheesy.
No, that was.
I thought it was cheesy because I mean I hadn't really thought about it until I was watching this, and I'm like, well, that kind of he was scary, and now you're making him kind of a joke.
No, that was perfect. The whole they really handled, by my opinion, they handled him well because again, he's supposed to be frightening, and I keep going back to it. When you see it the first time, and you're again, this is 1981.
Well, he is scary. I mean, he's scary. I thought that kind of defeated the purpose a little bit.
He really came across that way.
Yeah, I guess it didn't really sacrifice his scariness. Belloc is kind of the anti-Indy in that he says you are very much alike, you and I, which is a line you hear in movies all the time. We're going through all the tropes with this episode. He has an interest in seeing what the Ark is because of archaeology as well. He's not approaching it with the same humility that Indy is, and he ends up dressing up as Eli or one of the priests with the hat and everything, and deciding that he's going to open the Ark, even though apparently he's not Jewish. He better not be, because I have a feeling that the other guys would not have liked that very much, but. In the end, his pride is his downfall.
Isn't it always?
Yeah. Our buddy C.S. Lewis has quite a lot to say about that.
Five.
In fact, he says in Mere Christianity that pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man. We say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good-looking, but they are not. They are proud of being richer, or cleverer, or better looking than others. In God, you come up against something that is in every respect immeasurably superior to yourself. Unless you know God as that, and therefore know yourself as nothing in comparison, you do not know God at all. As long as you are proud, you cannot know God. A proud man is always looking down on things and people, and of course, as long as you are looking down, you cannot see something that's above you. If anyone would like to acquire humility, I can, I think, tell them the first step. The first step is to realize that one is proud. And a biggish step, too. At least nothing can be done for it. If you think you are not conceited, it means you are very conceited indeed. Mr. Belloc.
Once more, Mr. Jones, there is nothing that you can possess that I cannot
take away. He's a jerk.
He's a opportunist.
Yeah,
he's a capitalist.
Well, he's one of those darn Brits. So...
He's French.
Oh, was he French?
Belloc.
Yeah, I guess.
So. Well, says, I mean, Paul Newman. Frenchman. Belloc.
Belloc.
And that's him. Belloc.
Oh yeah. I saw him in a Poirot episode not long ago, and he's a British guy in real life. So that's what I'm thinking of.
Sala was in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, Sala. Let's talk about Sala.
Just for a minute, we got to wrap up.
We've got a few minutes left. We'll talk about Sala and Marion, kind of our two secondary good guy characters. Sala, I think, is one of the best sidekicks of all time.
Asps. Very dangerous.
You go first. Yep.
Yeah, I agree.
And he, I mean, he's very supportive.
He was written very, very smartly because he's shrewd. He comes across to the Nazis as just a bumbling, stupid Arab, but the reality is he knows exactly what's going on. He knows exactly where the Ark is. He's very true to his...
And that's kind of a nice...
He's very true to his friend. He has a great family. There's a lot to like about Sala.
Yeah, and that's a nice subversion of the usual stereotype of kind of the...
Better than the U.S. Marines.
The stupid ethnic sidekick. Though I think Temple of Doom makes up for that one. Yeah, I really like Sala. He's very funny. He's very enthusiastic. He's a great foil to Indy because he's very different.
I am the master of the sea.
He's got a great voice. He kind of has everything that Indy doesn't have. Indy's a loner. Sala has the family, you know.
And Marion says, this is for your wife. For your children, and this is for you.
That is what she says. Which brings us to Marion, who I really like her. I think of the three different love interests in the three Indiana Jones movies, and we only count three of them, just for the record, not the fourth one. It just doesn't count. She's the best. You agree?
Yeah, yeah. And Marion is a nice name.
It is a nice name.
Yeah.
And I think she's really interesting because
she can drink a lot.
She can drink a lot, but people complain a lot about really passive female characters in movies that are in, you know, all the feminists complain about that. And I can see their point. I think that I really like that she isn't a passive heroine. She's not going to just sit around and let him rescue her all the time. But at the same time, I really like it that she's not unrealistically macho. She's not going to be able to beat up five or six big guys. It's just not realistic, and she knows that. And she's going to she's going to figure out a way to get out of it differently. She's going to drink Belloc under the table and use a knife. And so she's really interesting because she has that ingenuity as well. She really works well with Harrison Ford, and she can stick up to him. And
she's a good foil for him.
And or they're very much the same in some ways, and so she can. Yeah, I think they work very well together. But I think that's pretty much it. We getting to talk ratings now?
Sure. Go.
Go? Oh, I've got to go first this time. Well, you know, The Last Crusade has always been my favorite Indiana Jones movie.
Really?
I know. But that's because I liked it the best when I was a kid because it was the funniest. I'm curious to see what I think now that I'm older. I haven't watched it in a long time. I probably have to give it 5 stars. It's the best of its genre, I think, and it's probably better than The Last Crusade because I don't remember as much about The Last Crusade, but it's probably not as good. It really invented a new genre. It was very, it combined all sorts of different things, and there were a whole bunch of cheap knockoffs that you still see all the time. There are TV shows built around that sort of character. There are archaeologist TV shows, like this Zahi Hawass guy that my brother always follows, goes around with a fedora on because that's the image that you want to present.
I'm going to give it 5, too, because I'm a sentimental fool.
You and Spielberg.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, what movie are we going to do next?
Because, let me finish. Because it brings out the best of, it represents the best of what movies can do, on the entertainment side anyway. Because it is a, as I said before, just a rollicking good time. It's well written, it uses restraint, it's got great music, it's got great effects, it's got great acting. And it's just that's a killer combination, and even after all these years, I still enjoy watching it.
It ages very well. For a movie of that time period, now it's helped that it's a period film.
Yeah, and it's right on the edge of believability. I mean, I know it's unbelievable.
Yeah,
of course,
but Indy bleeds.
Yeah,
a lot of
right. That's true. That's good point.
And that also goes towards
shot,
the danger.
You know, he gets shot. And so...
and then he gets slammed in the face with a mirror.
Yeah. And so that's... I'm going to give it a 5. Based on that killer combination. It's a perfect storm of movie making.
Yeah. In that it's... To appeal to every 12-year-old boy ever, it's just perfect.
Yeah.
And it finds the 12-year-old boy in everybody.
What should we do next week?
I think we need to do The Godfather Part 2.
No.
I think so because I have all sorts of things. We just watched it, and I really want to talk about it.
We could do
and
Hidden Dragon, Crouching Tiger.
You know they're doing a sequel to that.
Is that right?
They are. It's going to be released on Netflix next year.
Is what's his name in it?
No.
That's too bad.
Anyway, we are getting so sidetracked in this episode. Okay. I think we need to do The Godfather Part 2 because we're probably going to record several episodes next week.
I didn't like that movie.
You didn't like it? Well, we'll have lots to talk about because right. I really liked it. Spoiler. And we're probably going to record a few episodes because it's the Thanksgiving week and we're both off. And we'll be doing nothing but sitting around and stuffing our faces with turkey.
That's not true.
It's true.
We'll be going to Dan's to eat turkey.
Yep, our local Godfather.
Hey, Dan.
Hey, Dan. We'll talk to you about The Godfather then.
Yep.
I guess that's pretty much it for this week. If you want to find us online, you can check us out at www.longview95.blogspot.com, the Pilgrims Podcast blog. Individually, we blog at www.longish95.blogspot.com. That's mine. And kingharryv.blogspot.com. What's he that wishes so? That's the patriarch. Check us out on Facebook and on Twitter. Email us with some comments or criticism. You agree with our assessment of the movie, let us know, and we'll read your comments on the air. thepilgrimspodcast@gmail.com. You know, I just had an idea. I think that Indiana Jones is all a metaphor about government intervention. Yeah, I mean, seriously, think about it. The government turns up and hires Indy to go off and make something or to find the Ark of the Covenant. And the instant he gets it, they take it away. You know, that it's totally a metaphor about taxes and everything. You like your ark, you can keep your ark. And they take it away from you. So, until next week, never trust the government.